the real estate crash here? Is inflation coming back? What is Apple's disaster? What's going on with Matterport stock? Is Donald Trump going to debate at the next Republican debate coming up soon? And what about reaction to the Fed? Are rates ever going to come back down? Let's talk about all this and more in today's Bottom Line Report. Today's report is brought to you by the brand new Noobverse Pro crash courses on specific subjects you all have been asking for. Go to meetkevin.com to learn more about these specific crash courses releasing soon. As they release, the pricing will be higher. So check them out, as some of them are starting for just $79 now as crash courses. Check those out again at meetkevin.com. America's biggest landlord, apparently, is now struggling to find properties to buy. This is a pretty big surprise for a lot of folks, and it might be an indication of what's to come, because some of these big landlords are actually starting to dump. And what that could mean for us in terms of a real estate reset, well, let's just say it could get juicy. Let's take a look at this piece from the Wall Street Journal, which goes deep on America's biggest landlord. Invitation Homes and American Homes for Rent are some of the largest landlords in America, and they are lamenting that they are having trouble finding homes to buy. They say, quote, "We write hundreds of offers every week at price points that we'd be willing to transact at," Invitation Homes chief executive Dallas Tanner told investors this summer, "but we're striking out quite a bit." Landlords with 1,000 properties or more accounted for 0.4% of home purchases during the second quarter. That's down from 2.4% in 2021. In other words, these mega landlords are buying less of the homes that are actually transacting, and part of that could be because prices are so high. But it's not just that prices are high right now, it's also that some of these companies are starting to actually dump real estate. And this creates something really interesting. For about a year and a half, I've been warning that the real estate market is going to face pain when we start seeing institutions dump real estate, because it's not going to be mom and pop 30-year fixed rate mortgage owners who are dumping their real estate with this locked in sub 3% rate. It's institutions who have to free up their capital, because it doesn't make sense to own real estate at a 4% cap rate when you could get a money market fund paying you 5.5%. These companies aren't built to try to make money during these times. They're built to make money during the easy times. They're not built for the hard times where buying wedge deals is what creates profit for them. That's not what these companies are built for, unlike my real estate startup, which of course you could read the prospectus on and learn more about at househack.com since we're now fundraising. But Invitation Homes owns about 83,000 homes. And listen to this. They've been actively selling homes that have appreciated at the point where the properties are now yielding less than 4%. And instead, what they're doing is they're selling these properties and they're throwing the cash in the bank. They've also started buying properties from other institutions at a discount off of what those companies bought the homes for in 2021. Invitation Homes just bought 1,870 homes from Starwood Real Estate Trust, a company that's now upside down on those homes they speculated on during the bubble in 2021, and Invitation Homes is trying to pick them up cheaper. But I'll tell you, if it weren't for those 1,870 homes, Invitation Homes would have actually sold more homes than they ended up buying. That's because they added just 470 houses in 2023 so far, and they sold 675. That means they would have been net sellers had it not been for that Starwood acquisition. American Homes for Rent is also becoming a net seller. Look at this. They were a net seller during the first half of 2023, selling nearly 1,100 homes while adding just about 780. Most of them newly built homes, many of those that they're building themselves in markets where they can still get higher cap rates. Now, some of these markets are seen as riskier, which is why they often go for newer built homes so they can minimize their risk. Areas like Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Cincinnati, New Orleans, Chicago, Detroit, they're still sitting around these 6-7 caps because you're usually trading with higher poverty and you're taking on more eviction risk. In other words, you're going for a riskier, potentially lower quality property, trying to offset that with newer construction to squeeze out some yield. But you're really sacrificing quality properties by doing that, potentially, some argue. What's fascinating, though, is the takeaway from all of this is that when institutions are starting to sell, you might be getting closer to the point where blood is starting to flow in the streets. And I believe that's where some of the juiciest real estate deals can be bought. Potentially this winter, we'll see exactly that. More institutions becoming net sellers, especially as things get tougher in the winter time. Usually the only people who have to sell in November, December are not the choice movers who are, you know, trying to upgrade their home or move closer to their childhood schools. It's people who have to sell because they're getting squeezed out, as in an institution is getting squeezed out, an Airbnb speculator is getting squeezed out, somebody who speculated thinking they'd be quickly able to refinance as rates come down, they get squeezed out. These are people who are going to have to sell. They won't be able to make the payments anymore, and they create a great opportunity for you to go buy or for us to buy over at House Hack. Anyway, pay attention to the real estate market because there's definitely some pain coming to the real estate market. Next, what's going on with inflation? Well, FedEx just reported that package prices were actually down about 2% in the last quarter. And they picked up about 400,000 packages worth of volume from the Yellow bankruptcy and the UPS strike drama. FedEx also says, thanks to a reduction in costs, their profit beat and their profit expectations going forward are expected to continue to beat. This is something that's very exciting for FedEx because they're really telling the world, hey, look, prices are going down for packages, but we're able to produce more profit because we're running the ship stronger and more efficiently. This is leading FedEx stock to move about 6% in pre-market to the upside, which is quite exciting. But take a look at what's going on with the inflationary trends in something that's been pretty inflationary. Pet foods. Yeah, pet foods. Pet foods now facing potentially lower prices. Look at this. Pet owners resort to cheaper food as inflation weighs on wallets. Pet food is typically one of the last places that people go to save money. And guess what, folks? It's finally happening. First, it starts with discretionary purchases for pets, like buying less toys, which are usually high-margin pet items. Then, even though pet food is up 11% from a year ago, we're finally starting to see premium dry dog food losing share at an accelerating rate, down 2.9 percentage points in just the last 3 months, ended July, compared to a year ago. You're starting to see dis and deflation. This is good. This is one of the last holdouts to kind of get prices down for goods, or at least the rate of inflation down. That's what we need. We need to see this spread throughout every level. I remember last year, a course member actually sent me a message and said, hey, I run a pet supply store in Vegas, and we're still seeing price increases. And I thought, okay, when that turns, it'll be a sign that we're starting to get towards the end of the cycle. And here's a Wall Street Journal piece telling us that that inflation is actually here, or that disinflation, right? That disinflation is finally turning in some of those leftover categories. Now, obviously, we still have work to do. We have a Fed that's convinced we need to be higher potentially forever, and that's leading to some nervousness in markets. In fact, quite literally, there is an article now in the Wall Street Journal talking about higher interest rates, not for longer, but potentially forever. Yes, that's literally the article title here. And that's because now you have a Fed that potentially is signaling, hey, look, we don't really know what's going on. We're creating these projections based on what people think, which are 20 bank presidents and voting members combined. They throw their little estimates and dot plots down, whatever. But they're not even all voting members. So this whole dot plot and SEP projections thing, it's all fine and dandy, but what really matters is what's actually happening in the economy. And when Jay Powell yesterday was asked, well, what's actually happening then? Like, what are we going to do? He basically told us, I don't really know. Soft landing's the goal, but it's not the base case. So we'll just play it by ear, and 3 months of disinflating data doesn't make a trend, so we'll just take it one step at a time. And so obviously that led the Treasury market to sell off once again, which the Treasury market's already been facing a supply issue, right? You've got the government borrowing so much money. What do? They then have more Treasury bonds available. You not only have the government offering more Treasury bonds available, debt rising over $33 trillion now. We added $1 trillion of debt in just the last 30 days. It's remarkable. But beyond that, you've got the Federal Reserve dumping Treasury bonds via quantitative tightening. It's the opposite of QE, right? And you've got low appetite for bonds because every time somebody buys bonds, yields just end up going up even higher. And as yields go up even higher, your bond values lose principal value. It's too risky to be in bonds. So just go buy money markets at 5.5%. It's crazy. 10-year Treasury right now, 4.43%. That's insane. It is the highest we've seen in this entire cycle. And guess what that ends up doing? Drives mortgage rates over 8%. Yeah, you have a 740 credit score today, they will be over 8%. Scary. So what about the idea about higher interest rates, not just for longer, but maybe forever? Here it is. On Wednesday, Fed officials surprised the markets by signaling interest rates won't fall as much as previously planned. Consider that they're only expecting rates to fall. And this is kind of the scary thing, right? They're only expecting rates to fall to 5.1% by the end of next year. That is, by the end of 2024. They're only expecting rates to go down to 5.1%. That's like nothing. That's basically like not even cutting at all. I mean, the market expects rates to go down to 4.7%, but basically no cuts. Then a year after that, the end of 2025, maybe we get down to 3.9, and then maybe by 2026, we get down to 2.9%. In other words, you literally are cutting at a rate of only 0.08% per month over the next 28 months. Think about that for a moment. I think we literally overlook how blatantly slow the current projections are. The current projections are that over the next 28 months, we will cut rates by about 2.2 to 2.4%. Works out to roughly 0.08% of cuts per month. In other words, to get one full percentage point, 100 basis points divided by 8 basis points of cuts is over a year to get down 1%. And this is exactly why now you've got stories like this here in the Wall Street Journal suggesting, maybe rates are going to stay high for a very long period of time. To some extent, people believe that maybe this is just talk. That is, maybe the Fed is just trying to talk inflation into the grave for sure. After all, Jay Powell finally rolled and said it. People hate inflation, and we need to make sure that inflation goes away forever. And so by doing that, we just keep talking that rates are going to stay high until we're convinced inflation is gone, and then we can always rapidly cut. And so that's the premise behind this idea, that maybe the neutral rate is higher and we need to force rates down inflation down by having a higher rate path for much longer. This is problematic, though, because a lot of people are like, wait, does that mean the stock market is going to suffer? I mean, think about it. If rates are going to stay high this long, and rates are only going to fall at a slow pace, then is there potentially a risk to the stock market in such a slow move down with rates? Well, T.S. Lombard actually thinks, no, not necessarily. In fact, listen to what T.S. Lombard, and they're usually the bears, okay? Generally the bears. Listen to what T.S. Lombard thinks is actually the best for risk assets like stocks. Look at this. Here's a piece from T.S. Lombard. Out right after the Fed meeting, so it incorporates news from the Fed meeting. And I want to jump right to an important segment right here. Look at this. We are not yet in danger of undoing 12 months of disinflationary progress, despite what's going on with oil, right? Okay, good. It's great. But what about this here? A recession with deep cuts would end up leading risk assets to struggle. So they're arguing that if we end up getting a recession where the Fed has to panic cut, that's when you're going to see pain in risk assets, because that's when you're likely going to see bankruptcies. That's when you're going to see earnings crash. That's when you're going to see layoffs. That's when you're going to see real pain. Even though we might want those big cuts because it means, yay, cheap money again, it would come on the back of a lot of earnings pain. And it's actually not what you want. So be careful what you wish for. The idea of we want big cuts may be the opposite of what we actually want as investors. T.S. Lombard, they're the bears, folks. And what do they argue? They say the following: gradual cuts intended to normalize would support risk assets in the near term, as well as an FX cover rally. This is more for your foreign exchange traders. But point of this T.S. Lombard piece here, what's so fascinating is that this idea that maybe, just maybe, the reason the Nike swoosh is playing out, the reason even the bear Morgan Stanley's Mike Wilson says, wow, mega caps might do great, is because mega caps give you less of an opportunity cost, right? If you're sitting in money market funds, you potentially miss out on markets going up, right? So mega caps and the big growth stocks and the big tech stocks and the NASDAQ stocks, whatever, they give you less opportunity cost risk, because you're exposed to the market. So in theory, you don't have an opportunity cost risk. Okay, so they give you less of that. But what else do they give you? Well, in the event that you go into a recession and risk assets get hurt, the biggest companies will be most likely to survive. But if you don't go into a recession, they're also most likely to succeed in this winner-take-all environment that we're in. They have the lowest borrowing costs. They're borrowing, like Microsoft, around 3% while they're reinvesting their cash at 5 to 5.5%. It's insane. At the same time, they're the ones probably most primed to benefit from the artificial intelligence revolution, because they have the money to spend on CapEx to capitalize on the actual efficiencies of artificial intelligence, versus every American consumer who's like, OpenAI, whatever, man, I'm just trying to pay the gas bills. It's crazy. It's a crazy environment that we're in, that the bears are literally now coming out and saying, yeah, you know, maybe this like slow cutting phase is actually exactly what you want for risk assets, because it just aligns with the Nike swoosh recovery that Kevin's been talking. They may as well just say, me, Kevin's been talking about this forever. Nike swoosh recovery. Yes, he's also been saying it's going to be volatile, a volatile Nike swoosh. Never promised it was all just going to go straight up. Although, honestly, if you look at the week, if you just look at the NASDAQ on the basis of a week chart, it feels almost like it's just gone straight up. So a little volatility is maybe the price to pay for some of the gloriousness that's been occurring. But anyway, take a look at this. Break-evens. We know that break-evens have risen. I've been complaining about break-evens rising, the five-year break-even up, the five-year forward break-even up. They did fall after Jay Powell's hawking. But what do we know about the five-year break-even? Well, one big thing that we know is that, at least according to T.S. Lombard, they have not risen as aggressively as you would think based on the rise in energy prices, specifically oil. This is a fancy way of saying, hey, look, ordinarily, when you have oil prices spiking the way they have, about 30% over the last quarter, and hedge funds going all in on freaking oil right now, ordinarily, you would see a much larger move towards, well, break-evens going up. You would see fear. You would almost see uncertainty priced into these break-evens. But you're not seeing that. Not only are you not seeing that, but you're seeing Jay Powell, who's looking at the break-evens going up, and he literally said, and I quote, even financial markets suggest inflation expectations remain well anchored. That's powerful. Very, very powerful. It's almost as powerful as being able to say that you can get access to a crash course on a very specific topic like sales or buying your first home or renovating or stocks for as little as $79. Fundamental analysis, really, really good. Those don't include live stream access, but you can bundle in live stream access. But they give you really good crash course material, and it'll all be brand spanking new material. So if you want to bundle up with the Profit Portal, which is all of our existing courses, or you have questions, send us an email at staff@meetkevin.com. But remember how I was saying that hedge funds are going all in on oil right now? It's the trade. It's kind of like when shorting Tesla was the trade. You want to know what's kind of crazy though? Look at hedge fund allocation on oil. You ready for this? This should not come as a surprise to you. Hedge funds are plowing into oil. They are going, oil, baby. And everybody's estimating that. That's it. Oil's going to go to the moon. Why is oil going to go to the moon? Because the hedgies are in it. Of course, they're publishing bull pieces on oil going to 120 so they can squeeze their profits out of oil. Be wary of what the hedgies and suits are telling you. Always be aware of what people's positioning is. You should know my positioning. I run an actively managed ETF. It's a transparent ETF, for goodness sakes. For goodness sakes, it literally every single day tells you what the positioning is. And I'm blunt about that, okay? I realize everyone's got biases, but that's okay. That's what makes us different. But the Nike swoosh has proven correct so far, and I think it's going to keep coming. I also think that real estate pain is coming. You want to buckle up for that real estate pain. Don't worry so much about this oil trade. This oil trade, at the same time as you've got floundering China and a floundering Europe, we really think that this oil trade is going to hold? Probably not. In fact, even this piece right here suggests it's not economically driven. This is driven by supply chain restraints by OPEC Plus and trading. In other words, when you get OPEC Plus and Russia saying, hey, we're all going to cut, and then all of a sudden all the hedgies plow in going, oh, well, they're going to cut. And then they all write institutional pieces about, oh, oil's going to 100. And they trade it in that direction. And when they dump it, it gets rapidly dumped. It happens time and time again. This is why Jay Powell on our bingo card said, literally, we are going to look through energy price volatility. Because this is the crap that happens all the time. He said it's a very bad tool for predicting future inflation. Yes, is it going to affect headline inflation? Who cares? It's going to temporarily affect headline inflation. Nobody said inflation was going to go down in a straight line. Not a big deal, though. Look at Kroger. Look at FedEx. Look at the pet stores. Look closely at inflation data. It is gone. It's gone. Leftovers of it are going away. Leftover inflation. I don't know. Even Peter Schiff is like, yeah, inflation's gone. I respect Peter Schiff. Respectable answer. Inflation is gone. But who really won here? Well, not the American. You're still stuck with higher prices. That's the argument Peter Schiff makes. And he's not wrong. He's right. The inflation is still here. But the actual continuous increase is gone. Now, we've got to talk Apple and some more Matterport and stock analysis. But first, a quick tangent on Donald Trump. The Wall Street Journal editorial board went as far as suggesting that Donald Trump is afraid to debate, that he is ducking exchanges with his competitors who could challenge his record. Donald Trump is expected to skip the next debate at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library here in Simi Valley, California, which is about 30 minutes away from where I live. The debate will be held on the 27th at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific time. I'll be covering it live, just like I did the last time. But I want you to know something about the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal's editorial board is basically paid for by Rupert Murdoch. Murdoch controls News Corp, which owns the Wall Street Journal. Guess what Murdoch also controls? The Fox Corporation. Who's running the debate? Trump isn't going to. And Donald Trump will be instead conducting a rally to union members to once again get media attention while the Fox debates go on. It's brilliant. Last time it was Tucker Carlson. This time it'll be union members during the union strikes. Of course, he's going to blame Biden. He's going to blame electric vehicles. Though I think Donald Trump, this is my opinion. I like to be transparent, okay? Y'all have asked for more of my opinion. I'm going to tell you when I give you my opinion, and I'm going to be as unbiased as possible after that. When I give you my opinion, Donald Trump has really got to stop bagging on electric vehicles. They're a lot better range. They're not as big of a headache as they used to be. And he has started softening. He started to say, hey, just let people have a choice. You want a gas car, you want an electric car, that's fine. But I think he's making a losing argument, slamming on this idea that electric cars are so bad and that, you know, Biden's only pushing EVs. It's true they're pushing EVs, but I don't know that it's a winning argument to say that's so bad. But anyway, that's just my piece. You can chastise me for that. Let's take a look at the rest of this piece here. So the Wall Street Journal editorial board is arguing that Donald Trump should make his stance clear on abortion. Donald Trump, I actually talked about this a couple days ago, I thought had this very well put together argument that is very convincing to people who like Donald Trump. He says, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sit down with people on the left. I'm going to sit down with people on the right. And we're going to come to a compromise on how many weeks. And we are going to have a solution on abortion. A lot of people hear that and they're like, hell yeah, Trump's going to solve the problems. He's a fantastic salesperson. Very, very smart. Very, very, very smart approach. You can't alienate anyone like that when you just say, I'm going to solve it. It's very smart. It is a very, very smart approach. Editorial board says he should come out and actually give his position. How many weeks is it, Mr. Trump? Donald Trump is also encouraged to give some insight on his tariff and trade policies. For example, the editorial board here suggests, hey, you know, Trump, you've been talking about imposing a 10% tariff on all U.S. imports. That's going to cost somewhere around $300 billion a year and potentially lead to some retaliation from other countries. What say you about that? Why don't you come debate that? Now, obviously, a lot of Donald Trump supporters are going to say, look, Trump doesn't need to debate. We know what he's like as president. And quite frankly, how much is he really going to be able to answer in a debate? And I actually have to agree with that. I actually don't think you're going to get the most color out of Donald Trump in a debate because these debates are all just like little news snippets, clipping. That's all these debates really are. You get these things answered in an interview. That's when you get these done. We need to interview Donald Trump. Petition, meet Kevin to interview Donald Trump. Somebody make it happen. Anyway, I think this is very interesting because Donald Trump was Mr. Tariff on aluminum, steel, Chinese imports. I mean, we're talking about tariffs between 10 to 25%. So he's done this before. Now, something that I do think is very interesting is you have some talk about these 10% tariffs potentially being costly, not just because of the fact that it will make things more expensive, given that we've got about $3 trillion of trade to the tune of about 10%, so $300 billion a year. Somebody has to pay for that. But the Tax Foundation, for example, and they're super anti this idea, by the way, of a 10% tariff. A lot of economists don't like tariffs because there's always deadweight loss here. But anyway, what they argue is that not only would we face inflation, higher prices, but that we would actually hit our GDP because of the response we would end up getting from foreign governments. They expect that a 10% tariff on all imports would reduce U.S. GDP by 0.7% and eliminate 505,000 full-time jobs. Now, of course, this is a protectionist policy. When Donald Trump says, I'm going to do a 10% tariff and we're going to have a shield around America, what he's saying is we're going to invest in America. We're going to make America more competitive by making other stuff more expensive, like Chinese goods more expensive. And to some extent, there could be a way to argue that this is functional. And I'm going to show you how this could be functional. But first, let me give you the bear piece. The bear case on this is negative 0.7% to GDP and a loss of 505,000 jobs. That's the bear piece right here. But it's not just that. After all of the retaliation that we might get from foreign governments, we might further reduce GDP another 0.4% and eliminate another 322,000 jobs. This means potentially eliminating over 825,000 jobs and shrinking the economy by about 1.1%. In other words, they're going as far as saying maybe Donald Trump could literally push us into a recession if he went for this 10% cut. Okay. Or 10% tariff, I should say. The Bank of England, by the way, just left rates unchanged after their lower than expected inflation read. So keep that, keep an eye on some news coming out from the Bank of England and this idea that maybe the central banks are going to talk tough, but they're all secretly at peak levels. Anyway, okay, so this is the bear piece on Donald Trump, right? So what is potentially a positive argument on this, since I do want to give both sides of this, okay? So the other flip side argument of this is actually written by somebody you wouldn't think would write this. It's actually coming from the left. And what professors and economists from the left are arguing is that a 301 authority allowing Donald Trump to potentially unilaterally institute these tariffs could end up leading anyone close to America to benefit while punishing anyone outside the circle. Think about it kind of like the circle of trust. You remember Meet the Fockers and Meet the Parents? The movie was great, okay? Robert De Niro, there's a circle and you're either in it or you're not. So think about it like this. Circle of trust, here's the circle, here's you, China, and let's bring in anybody we want. Mexico, come on in. Canada, come on in. Did you know that if you combine trade between Mexico and Canada, you actually have almost three times as much trade between America, Mexico, and Canada as you do between America and China? How crazy is that? Most people don't realize that or think about that. I'll give you the exact numbers here because I think it's worth seeing. And then I want to tell you about this circle. But let's look at the exact numbers right here. So what do we have right here? Look at this. Trade with Mexico accounted for 15.4% of goods exported and imported by the U.S., just ahead of America's totals with Canada at 15.2%. Well, add that together. What do you get? 15.4 plus 15.2%, that's 30.6%. Where does China sit? At 12%. So 30.6 divided by 12% is 2.55 times as much trade goes to Canada and Mexico combined with the United States when you compare it to China. China amounting just to 12%. And again, Mexico and Canada amounting to 30.6%. It's kind of wild. A lot of people are like, oh, we trade so much with China. Be surprised. Actually trade a lot more with our domestic partners via free trade. And this is thanks to, you know, the agreements that we have, the alliances that we have between China and Canada. But it's actually very interesting because if you go to this Meet the Fockers idea, you could actually set Donald Trump up with his 10% tariffs to negotiate the winners on the inside of the circle and then target the pain to countries like China, which could be then a tool, or even Russia, which could then be a tool to limit their ability to maybe invade Taiwan or otherwise. Listen to this. Ultimately, Donald Trump's plan could result in a new U.S.-led system of managed trade with terms that are beneficial to the U.S. and its allies while punishing anyone outside the club like China. Despite the rise of China hawks in Washington, this plan will undoubtedly provoke a big backlash from U.S. companies. But that never stopped Donald Trump from using America's most powerful trade tools to deliver his campaign promises. See, look, my goal is to be unbiased here. It's my goal. We can be unbiased. We can give you both sides of the spectrum. And that's very, very important. Speaking of the spectrum, you know what's on the spectrum? Apple. But maybe not with their own modem. Wall Street Journal now running this spectacular piece called Inside Apple's Spectacular Failure to Build a Key Part for Its New iPhones. It's basically a fantastic piece about how Apple has no freaking idea what they're doing with modems. That they can build chips like the M2 chips or A17 chips, and that these are actually easier to build. But modem chips are hard because you need them to work with 2G, 3G, 4G, LTE networks, 5G networks, and Apple chips have been overheating. They haven't been able to assemble the experts within Apple, the employees, to actually be able to pull it off. Back in 2017, Apple's like, we're done with you, Qualcomm. We, quote, hate your guts, is what insiders at Apple say. That Apple hates Qualcomm's guts. That Apple sued Qualcomm in 2017. They ended up settling this in 2019. But Apple now capitulated and said, you know what, we've announced a deal that we're actually just going to work with Qualcomm throughout 2026 because we can't get our own act together. Apple really wants to profit more from having their own chips. In fact, when Apple moved to their own M2 chips away from Intel, the expectation is that Apple was able to make $75 to $150 more per computer in profit because they had their own in-house chips. Margin, baby, that's pricing power. That's delicious, but they're failing on the modems. But you know what? Maybe that's not so bad because look at this, folks. Those Qualcomm modems, apparently, are actually really good. Look at this test. And I was actually looking at this quite a bit because I'm like, do I want the iPhone 15? I don't know. You know, I've been really complaining about the iPhone 15. And I was comparing the Qualcomm chip in the iPhone 14 to the iPhone 15. And spec-wise, it's not obvious that it's any better. When you compare the specs, it looks like you've got the same bands, the same antenna. But it is the new Super Dragon chip from Qualcomm. And when you put it through tests, at least speedsmart.net pulled off some tests. Look at some of the tests they pulled off. Upload bands, you're roughly the same. So for those of you like me who are uploading YouTube videos, maybe those upload speeds won't be any faster on an iPhone 15 compared to a 14. They'll definitely be faster compared to an iPhone 13. But look at those download speeds. Download speeds somewhere up to 24% faster. On Verizon, you're going to 243 versus 195 megabits down, 300 versus 245 T-Mobile, 204 versus 178 on AT&T. Those are significant download speed improvements. That's kind of tempting. It's not the only thing that's kind of tempting. I'm going to talk about a second thing that's pretty tempting about the iPhone 15. Right after I mentioned, did you know that Apple apparently stole about 40% of Google Maps business thanks to releasing Apple Maps? Yeah. Here's a piece by The Information via Yahoo Finance, suggesting that almost 2 years later, we were at 40% of the prior peak. Google insiders talking about the loss to Apple Maps being potentially about 40% of Google Maps' volumes on cell phones. Wild. Shows you the power of Apple. But it's not just this, folks. You know the other thing that I respectfully haven't paid attention to as much as I should have? It's the fact of 3D spatial video. Now, I'm going to show you something that I think is pretty cool about spatial video. It's a little nerdy, but take a look at this clip on spatial video. If you don't have the iPhone 15, you're not going to have the ability to record video in spatial video. Why do you care about this? Because if you have babies that happen to be born soon, because I got twins on the way, and who knows, maybe more for next year. Maybe there's something Kevin hasn't talked about yet, and you want spatial video of these children. Maybe not while they're on their way out, but you know, after, when they're born, you gotta have the iPhone 15. It's like, Remember for a moment what spatial video is. Here it is. This is what it would look like on the Apple Vision Pro.
You live a memory as if you're right back in the exact moment.
Hey, Dad!
Now, this is super nerdy, but take a look at this. This is how they explain to developers what spatial video is. And it's an Apple-provided video, and basically they're like, hey, look at that text that popped up on screen. Doesn't that actually feel weird? Like, where things are can create depth conflict. And depth conflict is something that we have to resolve. But basically, if you look closely on screen now, you could see that the image that is technically the left photo shows more of that flower to the left of that bird's head than the right image. And as they merge these two together, you get the feeling of depth. It's basically because you have a left eye and a right eye, right? And therefore you see things slightly differently, and that gives you depth perception. And now you can mimic that with Apple Vision Pro. This is really cool. And so if you were looking for a reason for the iPhone 15, that is pretty tempting. I don't know what it's going to actually look like yet. I probably want to try it out in an Apple store. The Apple Vision Pro headset isn't out yet anyway, but I will say, very, very, very cool, Apple. In other news, Poland is potentially threatening not to supply weapons to Ukraine anymore, but quite frankly, they've kind of already given everything that they have in their arsenal, and they're waiting to get resupplied by America, so they don't really have anything to gain anyway, and this is really just emotional posturing. The idea here is that Poland is tired of Ukraine dumping cheap grain on European countries. And so a lot of European countries have actually been banning the importation of Ukrainian grain. There's a lot of drama going on around this. I don't know that any of this is really a massive deal. I wanted to address it because I know people are going to ask about it, but it is not that big of a deal. Something to keep an eye on, but that's about it. It's also worth noting that oil is trading in heavy backwardation right now. That basically means that oil futures for the next year are trading well below $90 per barrel, anywhere between 88 in January all the way down to 80 next August. The prices where oil are right now are unrealistically high. They're not going to last that long. You've got a lot of trading going into this. This is as we saw with hedge funds, a lot of nonsense going into this. Beyond this, there is actually a real chance we might end up having some more near-term volatility thanks to, the potential of revisiting a government shutdown. It's not me saying this. It's not me trying to be political, okay? This is straight up from Punchbowl News. These folks are pretty dang good at, calling what's going to end up happening. And let me give you the Thursday morning briefing here. You ready for this? Here we go. McCarthy gave in to the right. He pushed his moderates to follow him and is pursuing a plan that'll be dead on arrival with the Senate and the White House. It very well could lead the government to a shutdown on October 1st. In fact, it may be unavoidable at this point. Basically, here's what McCarthy's going to do. He's going to try to pass a stopgap funding bill. But a lot of Republicans aren't going to go for this unless it has many cuts to discretionary spending. So they're going to give Democrats in the Senate and Joe Biden in the White House a $1.47 trillion level in discretionary spending. That's what Republicans are trying to go for. Democrats want more money. They're also not going to include any Ukrainian money or disaster relief money. Both of those things are what Democrats want. They want Ukrainian money. They want disaster relief money. Even some Republicans are like, please provide the Ukrainian money, like Lindsey Graham, Collins, whatever. It's not going to happen. So you're going to have another showdown. Then McCarthy's going to be between a rock and a hard place. McCarthy's going to have to decide, do I actually put something together that Democrats are going to go for because we have a split Congress, or do I hold firm? Remember, Donald Trump is really aggressive. I wrote this down over here as well. McCarthy has a tough decision to make. I wrote Trump pressure as well. Trump's the guy who's going to be on TV every day going, I would hold firm. I would get America's budget back into balance. Whether it's true or not, we've seen Donald Trump do the hard line. I'm not doing anything until I get my border wall funding and I'll shut the government down. I don't care. He's pulled that off before, so we know he's done it. Now the question is McCarthy going to do it? Is he going to be willing to risk a government shutdown? I don't think so. I don't think McCarthy will end up pulling that off. That's likely going to lead to more Republicans and people like Donald Trump saying things like, that's McCarthy for you. Government shutdown could be on its way. So what else is there to talk about? Well, folks, I want to be very clear about this. I really do believe there are going to be some beautiful opportunities coming up for real estate. I think House Hack, as the vanguard of real estate, is going to be extremely well positioned to take advantage of these opportunities. And if you're not ready to buy real estate, you don't have the cash to buy real estate, the credit to buy real estate, the knowledge to buy real estate, consider diversifying your investments from volatile stocks or other investments. Take a bit and invest into House Hack. Really excited. We've got some new tiered benefits as well, by the way. We're going to be announcing those. So if you invest, I think the first break is at about $19,600, somewhere right around there. And then $25,000. And then I think there's one at $70,000 and $100,000. Anyway, you'll get some benefits like video shout outs, You'll potentially be able to shadow us for free if you invest a certain amount and come see what we're actually doing with House Hack. It's on the ground, no cost to you, which is very fun. So there'll be some really cool benefits, but learn more first about House Hack, what we're doing, what the vision is. Just go to househack.com, read the prospectus, understand the risks involved, look at the pitch deck, look at the video, learn everything about House Hack. We're really excited about the fundraise that we're doing, and we're going to be closing that fundraise as well. Probably within the next 30 days, we'll see. It's going very, very well so far. So thank you to all of you who have invested. We've already doubled what we had people invest the first 24 hours of the first time we raised money last year. We already doubled that in the first 24 hours, which is really amazing. Great vote of confidence. So thank you. Big shout out to all of y'all. Now, before we finish, I did promise a brief analysis on Matterport. So Matterport stock is in the toilet. I've been out of the stock since January of 2022. I love Matterport as a tool, but as a stock, it's not that great. It might have some more pain ahead of it. It's at $2.19 right now. And so I decided to look at their earnings. It's got like a $659 million market cap. Still too much, in my opinion. And I think there's still more downside. But here's the problem. You've got negative cash flow. In the last 6 months, you're losing $110 million. Net cash from operating activities, so your free cash flow, once you take out plant, property, and equipment, sitting around negative $33 million for 6 months. This is a lot of money that's vanishing here. And where's that money going? Well, when you look at the income statement, you see that a lot of money is going to SG&A. And a lot of that is stock-based compensation. This company's getting squeezed for stock compensation when they can't even figure out how to make a profitable product yet. And it really pisses me off. You've got good subscription revenues that's profitable. You got $13 million of profit in your subscription revenues. But on services, you're barely making money, a couple mil. Product, you're losing money. And when you factor in the $18.8 million in R&D and $56 million in SG&A, what is this? This is supporting the livelihoods of executives and senior staff at Matterport, not the actual product. It's frustrating to me to see this. Now, balance sheet-wise, I see why they still have some hope. They have over $400 million of cash, somewhere around $440 million worth of cash, short-term investments, so your cash and cash equivalents. They don't have a lot of debt, less than $100 mil in short-terms and long-term payables. Therefore, they have shareholder equity of about $551 million. A lot of that cash and short-term investments, which is great, which means they do have the ability to weather the storm for a little bit longer. Consider, if they have negative cash flow of only about $15 million a quarter, they can weather the storm for a while. And that's a benefit. They could go through 26 quarters of losing $15 million of cash flow. Heck, they could just take their entire net loss of $50 million. And at $50 million, if that all came out of cash, they could get through 2 years of cash burn. So there is a potential upside in that they have the cash to burn. But I'm not convinced that Matterport is in a position to end up proving that it can continue to grow to where its revenues will ever offset its SG&A and R&D expenses. And that will keep the stock compressed because eventually that cash will be gone. And if you haven't grown to become profitable by then, that's when you start trending towards BK. I don't think Matterport's going to go BK, but they do need to either cut expenses substantially or become a whole lot more profitable. And this is not the environment to grow in. Sorry. Nobody's selling homes. There are no transactions. It's your biggest cohort. You got to get in with the property managers and contractors. But I don't even think they're advertising appropriately to them. That's always been my suggestion. I feel like I want to go in there and take the company by the helm and turn this company around, but I don't have the money to Elon Musk this company and fix it. But anyway, I do have my frustrations about the company, and I think it just remains an untouchable for now.
Why not advertise these things that you told us here? I feel like nobody else knows about this.
We'll try a little advertising and see how it goes.
Congratulations, man. You have done so much. People love you. People look up to you.
Kevin Paffrath there, financial analyst and YouTuber. Meet Kevin. Always great to get your take.